Welcome to Disruptive Successor, a show for next generation leaders in family businesses and entrepreneurs who want to disrupt the status quo and take their existing business to a whole new level. We all know that what got us here isn't going to get us there. This show will provide inspiration, advice, and resources to help you create massive impact.
This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, The Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Hi, this is Jonathan Goldhill here, and welcome back to another episode of the Disruptive Successor Show. And today I truly have a next generation leader and a disruptive successor. Ryan Margolin, CEO of Professional Hair Labs, set out on a journey to help create the world leading product in cosmetic bonding when his mother was poisoned by the harmful chemicals in the hair adhesive products industry, commonly used. Inspired to keep the same thing from happening to anybody else, his family dove into the research and created their first hair care product free of harmful substances. It's been 20 years now. Ryan's an international business leader and an entrepreneur who's been working in more than 15 different countries, based in Ireland and in Florida. Ryan has taken his company's manufacturing business and grown it tenfold and become one of the 500 fastest growing companies in the U.S. on the Inc. 500 fastest growing companies list, and has sold more than 50 million in product nationally. I'm so pleased to have you on the show today, Ryan.
Well, thanks for having me, Jonathan. I'm looking forward to having a talk.
So let's just unpack this story a little bit. So your mom and dad, right, are in this business, a similar kind of business to what you're in right now, maybe not as technologically advanced or sophisticated. And your mother develops like a horrible reaction to the products being used.
Yeah.
And these are so people understand, these are basically like wigs and hair replacement products that you would use to basically look like you have a full head of hair rather than doing something surgical, correct?
Exactly. And look, you know, the hair replacement industry is, you know, broken up into two sections. There's either surgical or non-surgical, and we operate in the non-surgical side. So, you know, going back to the origins, you know, my mother was a master hair technician, or is, should I say, and my dad was just a businessman, entrepreneur, if you will. Mm-hmm. And he was from the Bronx and she was Irish, and she moved to New York when she was young, and they ended up crossing paths, and one thing led to another, and they opened a few hair replacement studios between New Jersey, New York, and, you know, then Florida. And look, at that time, the hair replacement industry was deemed really too small to be governed by, you know, the FDA. So what happened was that manufacturers were able to produce products without having any real compliance requirements. So a lot of the stuff was solvent-based, full of chemicals, and, you know, without the correct ventilation or not truly knowing what was in the product. Over the years, that had a health impact, you know, and my mother eventually got chemical poisoning from that, and it caused her to retire early.
Wow.
So that's really what started this journey, because the follow on to that was my father decided at, you know, one point in not too long after that to sell his company or their companies. And he diversified then and changed paths into committing to create a safe product line for not only technicians, but for individuals who wear hair pieces or wigs.
Wow. So did this require some like real breakthrough in materials or technology or application or chemicals? I mean, your father really set out to invent something that didn't exist.
Correct. Yeah. And I suppose that was the difficult part about it. He worked very closely with a number of chemists over a number of, months and years to develop this product. And really what they had to do is they had to take a copolymer, a plastic base, and make it suitable for use on skin. Even if you look at preservatives in the products, the things that give them the shelf lives, some of those are, wash-on suitable, and some of them are leave-on suitable. And, a lot of the products in the industry at that time had preservatives which were only, wash-off suitable, which means that once they were applied to any surface, typically they should be washed off. And, right. That creates problems, allergies, reactions, burns. And that's really where, it was innovative for the industry, but the technology did exist to at least experiment with it to bring it together.
So I take it from our prior conversations that your dad was running a business that was sub seven figures. So it was a six figure business, was supporting the family. Is this the business that you grew up in? I mean, that like during your formative years, your dad was running this business and it was like, he was still trying to develop the technology and leverage and expand the business, but it really was stymied or stuck.
Yeah. So, when I grew up more so looking at the hair replacement side of things. So when they were in their studios, I commonly remember the products, the processes, the clients, mm-hmm. And, when my dad made the transition, I was located in Ireland. He was staying in America, in Florida, and I did visit quite a lot. So I do have a very clear memory of even helping him fill bottles, even out of where he started it, out of a garage.
Right.
So it's, the memories are there and watching where it started from versus where it was even at when I became involved in the business. And subsequently then after that, my two brothers becoming involved in the business, it's a very different animal, what showed me most out of all of that is the importance of having the right people on the team with the right, yep. with the right mindsets and the right experience as well.
I always say right people, right seats, doing the right things, doing them right. The trifecta or even the fourth thing of being like more efficient. So, so you've really taken this business, you've grown it tenfold. I love clients that come to me and want a 2 to 10x their business and need a playbook to do it. One thing I don't have in my playbook is how do you go from selling products nationally to selling them internationally? What are the challenges that you run into when selling in multiple different countries? And so can you share some of your experiences in that area?
Yeah. So here's the thing. At the very beginning, the changes that we made on the US operations to help it. And I'll give you an example. I joined the company in 2009, spent the first 6 months looking at the company and how it operated and where the problems were. We then took those, took all of that data and all of the knowledge, and we made some really, what I look at now is very simple changes, even to the way we marketed it, and launched new products. And within 18 months, we tripled revenue. So I was like, wow. Okay, we've figured a little bit out here, and it's been enough to reinvest to really expand the operations. So at that point, then we took a certain amount of money and we decided to open up an EU location. I was like, look, I got this. It was like, I've learned all of this stuff over the last 18 months. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to replicate and I'm just going to implement sure. it over here in the European side. So yep. that's exactly what I did in 2012. Mm-hmm. And within 6 months, it fell flat in its face.
Wow. So, okay. What happened?
Well, this was it. I didn't know what was going on. All I knew is that, what got us, to triple revenue over the space mm-hmm. of 18 months definitely wasn't going to be the same over here in Europe. So I was like, okay, we've got to do a little bit of digging. So, I spoke to a lot of, wholesalers, salons, distributors. I spent so much days and nights on the phone, asking questions. And what I realized really is that, the way culturally that, business owners do business in different places in the world now, they're totally different. And if you don't know how that's done, you're not going to get the same response. You see, what I learned in Europe is that people wanted those, really high performing products from America, but they weren't used to doing business the American way. Mm. And, you know, vice versa, you know, the Americans as well, they're not used to the way Europeans do business. And so it was a huge learning curve. So it took actually about another, I'd say 12 months to figure that out. I did, a few trade shows, spoke to a lot of people, and then we started to get some traction when we changed the way we did it. So essentially, while it was really the same company, we had two different operations because they were running so differently. And one of the biggest challenges we had then was, eventually when we hit a point of growth where we were like, look, we can't have these two companies running in different directions. The real challenge was bringing them together and making them operate in harmony. So that was a huge learning curve for me.
Mm-hmm. Now you have other family members in this business, right? So how do you guys all work together to figure out these kind of strategies? And like, do you have a set of, like, do you have a regular meeting that you guys do, like a weekly powwow or a monthly or a quarterly planning session? Tell us a little about the dynamics in your family business.
Yeah. So look, I mean, the dynamics, they're really straightforward. Over the years, it's myself and my two brothers that predominantly run the business. My dad is kind of involved in the company from a consulting perspective. So, any high level strategic, decisions we make, he would be involved in, and he'd give his input and advice. But we have daily meetings, we have weekly meetings. And, the word meeting even in itself is like, I think of meeting as this long drawn out thing. It's like, we like them to be very targeted. It's like, we have a set amount of time, let's bang out what we bang out. And you know what it actually has done for and I can speak on my brother's behalf, on their behalf with this as well, is that it's taught us how to make decisions faster with less information.
Yep.
And in today's day and age, when you're dealing with a lot of moving parts and you're dealing with a few different departments, like, we're not a huge company by any means. We're a small company. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's a lot of moving parts inside of it. So your day becomes about managing the information and making sure that you're not trying to manage a back burner, that you get a little bit of information, enough to make a decision, and then run forward. Mm-hmm. Now, being completely transparent, it doesn't always work out like that, but that's the methodology that we use.
Well, that's great. I mean, I teach the daily huddle, which is a 5 to 15 minute stand up. Sounds like you're doing a version of that. The weekly, which is basically a chance to process issues. The monthly, which is a chance to transfer some maybe learning or DNA or knowledge or maybe even do some training. And then a quarterly, which is, hey, let's set the goals for the quarter. Let's review how we did this past quarter. And annually, let's look strategically at, what should we be doing differently to differentiate ourselves from our competition, et cetera. So, look, you were able to achieve getting on the Inc. 500 fastest growing companies list, which is no small feat. What would you attribute some of your key success factors to?
Systems. Mm. It's as simple as that. When we hit $1 million, we broke. Mm-hmm. Our systems broke, our communication channels broke. And what I've learned now, moving in, we're operating in, the low eight figures, but I mean, we're still growing. Mm-hmm. What I've learned is that your business is always going to feel broken if it's growing, because there's always going to be things that you have to change. And once you become comfortable with that, I think, and you accept that, it makes the journey a lot easier, because it's just a part of growing, personally, yep, and professionally.
Yep. So, it's interesting. I used to probably 10 years ago tell people that if you're growing fast, and I define fast growing as anything north of 20% a year, because, basically if you're growing at 24% a year, you can use the simple Andrew Tobias rule of 72, divide 24 into 72 and know that every 3 years you're going to double your business. And if you're doubling your business in 3 years or in 5 years, you're going to outgrow your people, You're going to outgrow your systems. You're going to outgrow your space. You're going to outgrow your capital. And you're maybe going to outgrow your leadership capabilities or skills. So those are all five things you need to be thinking about and working towards. And so sounds like you've had the right mindset about that. So what are some of the best ways that you found to grow and scale a family business?
I think communication, the best way for us is, you know, as three brothers that are running, you know, the company, communication is key. It doesn't work out all the time, but I think when you have the right understanding and the ability to stop for a minute and reflect on your own actions or your own thoughts and how you can apply them to a situation to make sure, I wouldn't say that everyone is happy with everything, but that they understand that the goal, the end game is in alignment with each other. So, you know, sometimes you might not think it's the best decision or one person might not, but ultimately it still moves forward because there's 100% trust there that everything we do on a daily basis is to drive things forward. So yeah, communication is definitely one. Empathy would be another. The ability to understand each other's perspective and how it makes us, you know, feel. Because look, at the end of the day, you know, we all show up every single day, and so does our team. And, you know, there's times where things, you know, someone might be having a slow day or a slow week, or they might have some personal problems that ultimately are reflecting in the business. You know, and that's another big thing, you know, like I've learned that, you know, in most key areas where businesses aren't performing or in certain departments is that when you really get to the core of it, sometimes, you know, it's a case of where, you know, it's really people's personal problems reflecting in the business. It's not an actual business problem. Mm. So it's having the empathy to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and understand that, you know, there is something at the core here, and it doesn't necessarily have to be operational, or it doesn't necessarily have to be a product of the person not being able to do the role. It could be something just inside of their personal life that's reflecting in the business. So those, to me, communication and empathy are two big things.
Okay. So what's the secret sauce to you and your two brothers working so well together? I assume that's an assumption, you work well together. I mean, did you guys, are you the oldest? Is that why you're the CEO? And did you guys beat on each other when you were growing up? Or like, how did you all come to get along so well? Or do you guys just have a healthy trust? And how much of credit do we give to your mother and father for developing, for creating boys that get along well? So just give us a little bit of your family history.
Yeah. So look, I think it's a little bit of all the above. I mm-hmm. think there is a common trust there that we always do have each other's backs, even though there's, you know, there has been times where it hasn't been so straightforward. Mm-hmm. You know, how the positions inside the company were allocated is that we, you know, we had a couple of very long discussions about our strengths and our weaknesses individually and how we feel that, you know, the chemistry could be pulled together very well and apply them to the company to help them. We, you know, look, everyone has an ego, right? Everyone does. That's part of human nature. But the ability to put it to the side and look at things holistically is very important. And, you know, we, with our personalities and our dispositions, we have the ability to stop and do that. And I think that's where a lot of the results have come from, is the fact that, you know, we have not really let any challenges or any, you know, ego-based decisions get in the way of the benefit of the company. And, you know, look, sometimes that might be a stern conversation with each other. You look, I mean, they've been had with me. I've had them with my brothers. That's mm-hmm. part of, you know, being in a family business. But ultimately, I think that really comes down to the key of it. You know, look, everything we experience in our life, you know, is a product of learned behavior from somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
There's good and bad to that. But I think as an adult, you hit a point where you need to take a look at those parts of yourself and develop those and just really be as self-aware as possible, because at the end of the day, what you do affects everyone. So, you know, if you keep that in mind when you're moving forward and when you're making decisions, both personally and professionally, I think you're putting yourself in a position where you're in a better place than 95% of the individuals that are operating in businesses.
You know, I have to say, I'm really impressed. I think it's remarkable the way you speak about your family and the business. I think some families probably are challenged around money issues. I think people in general seem to have challenge around money issues. So I can imagine in a family business, maybe yours maybe you'll share with us, compensation, equity division. It's like, you know, do we do it like, okay, we're it's one third, one third, one third. We all earn the same, or do we have a conversation? Do we include other members and call them a board and have, you know, so we have a tiebreaker and makes a decision like, you know, is the CEO worth more or is the person who sells worth more? I mean, these are sometimes difficult conversations in families. Do you care to share any personal experiences in this area in your business?
What I can say on that level is that all of those conversations have to happen at some point. Mm-hmm. And realistically, I've been involved in some way, shape, or form throughout the years in many different situations and a lot of those conversations, not necessarily with my family either, you know, but my belief is that, especially if you're dealing in a familiar business where, you know, everyone is working inside of it and they're working in executive or leadership roles, I think there's more to be gained from an honest division between, you know, between assets and equals an equal division, because at the end of the day, you're in it, you know, for the better of the business, and you're in it for your family as well. You know, I don't care how many arguments or fights that you may have, or even what you really believe yourself, the way things should be in quotations. I think really, if you want to progress and you want to apply all of your resource and your brain power and your strategic everything to the company, it's much easier to move forward from a place of equality. And, and you know what, look, I mean, that's what's worked for us. I think it's a very honest way of doing things, and it's a very fair way. You know, as long as everyone is doing the best that they can to make sure that you're moving in the right direction.
Well, my grandfather and his two brothers built a very large clothing manufacturing business with a couple thousand employees. And I do believe that there was that equality amongst the three of them. And I don't believe that they each contributed equally. I believe that my grandfather and his one brother were more contributors. And I think that might have borne out when they sold the company. I think only two of them got lifetime employment contracts, which is pretty unheard of when you sell a business. But, you know, I went out and tried to start my own clothing business when I was in my middle 20s. And I found an artist and a partner, and we started a business together. And I have to say that the thing that failed about that business was we were not family members. And we were not on the same page. And his view towards me and the money that I was contributing, we were not equals, and we did not treat each other equally. And I learned a pretty tough lesson after about 6 months of being in a partnership.
Yeah, so, that's a thing. Yeah. You know, and look, I think, you know, moving outside of the familiar space, which you've just addressed. So whether it's money, whether it's capital, whether it's experience, whether it's network, whatever it is you bring to the table, mm-hmm. There's always going to be an imbalance of some sort. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're constantly looking for the advantage or what you should be getting more over somebody else, it's never going to be enough. It's almost going to be insatiable, you know, like, and you're never going to truly be able to, you know, if you're operating or growing a business, I think it's a really difficult position to be in, because ultimately it'll always be sitting on your shoulder here is that, you know, look, well, I brought this to the table and, you know, look, I should be paid more. It's like, in principle and in theory, should that be truth? Maybe. But let's look at what you want to be achieved. Let's look at the end goal here. How do we get there, maintain our relationship, and make sure that, you know, that we're doing things the right way? And that's why I'm a firm believer is that, you know, if you start a partnership, especially outside of family, is that, you know, look, just even it out and do what you can to move forward, because if not, you're going to get caught up in the particulars.
Oh, so good. So wise, so helpful. All right. I'm going to challenge you with a question around your why and your purpose. Typically, when I go into a company and start to work with even a next gen leader, I try and help them to figure out, like, what's your why here? What's the purpose? What is something that everyone can rally behind that's simple, concrete enough, you know, not some long mission statement that people try and remember and can't recite? And how is it different from what your mother or father set out to do? I am sure that you guys have had to do some work around this area, and that maybe your why was a little bit different, but that you came together and it's brought the cultural glue of your whole family together. So can you tell us a little bit about your why? Why are we in the, why do we care about people's hair and, you know, the way it looks? I mean, I know I cared about my hair, but like, tell us about a little about your company's purpose.
Yeah. So really this splits into two, because as you just said, Jonathan, my why back then is different to my why now. Mm. It does change, I believe. Maybe not at the core. For us, it's a generational business. So there was a why there before us, you know? So really the next generation of this company is about our why, but it doesn't forget the foundational why it began. So ultimately it was started, as said earlier, around, you know, my mother being poisoned chemically from the product she was using. And that was my dad's reason to transition and create this line. But that would have been my original motivator, because that was the company's motivation. Now it looks a little different for me, because I realize that, you know, once we look outside of hair loss and hair replacement, I mean, hair is an intimate thing. You know, people are very insecure about it, and it batters their self-confidence when they, not everyone now, but for a lot of people, when they lose it, their self-confidence hits the floor. Mm. We work with people every day. We see people every day in the same position, whether it's men, women, or children, you know? So for us, our main why of the company now is people first, you know? That's really where we're at, you know, customer service and people, because ultimately without that, our product is irrelevant and our services are irrelevant. So, moving outside of the hair space, we wanted to take the methodologies that were used and what we've learned over the years from the operations and apply it into the cosmetic space in general. We realized there are companies that do this currently, but what we really grew up around, myself and my two brothers, was not being afraid to push the boundaries of scientific innovation, especially when it came around, you know, cosmetics. So, you know, that's where we're going with this. You know, we're putting people first, but also trying to push the boundaries of innovation around, you know, around cosmetic products such as skincare and, you know, hair care and all the different types of cosmetics in between. So our why, it still remains the same of safety and people first. It is now really become about, you know, bringing that to a much wider audience and making sure that they know that everything that we put out to the marketplace is not only going to be, it's not just a product, it's going to be something that we've scientifically researched ourselves for a long time in conjunction with our own chemists. And we're bringing something to the marketplace that is aiming to, as cliched as it sounds, change people's lives, because
that's great. You know,
there's so many undiscovered, benefits to so many ingredients that are just now hitting the marketplace or have only been available for the last couple of years. And we're starting to play with them a little bit. So it's really fun, but we know we're doing everything in an environment that is going to benefit individuals using them.
That's great. And can now, I don't know, do you sell this? Is this a product products that are sold business to business, or do you also sell direct to consumers?
So this is a double-edged sword. Our business was predominantly and is predominantly B2B, right? We do offer B2C services over the last few months, only to combat the counterfeits that are on the marketplace. And I mean, I could talk about that part of our operations and learning for the next 8 hours. If there was one key part of our business that has really opened my eyes to the way things operate in the black market, it's counterfeit products.
Wow.
And, you know, so we.
So you've had to protect your brands. And you have IP, I understand, as well, that you're trying to protect. You have patents.
Absolutely. And look, I'm very open about our journey through that process. You know, look, it all started with, you know, we originally trademarked everything in the United States and, you know, subsequently moved to Europe to do so. What we didn't realize is that, you know, we shouldn't have waited in some key countries to protect our trademark rights, because they're the key countries that are notorious for counterfeit products. And this wasn't about just selling online. These counterfeits were able to penetrate our distribution channels, which hurt a lot, you know.
Wow.
So we had to move very fast over the last couple of years to, we're never going to get rid of it completely, but we've made it very difficult for counterfeiters now to get away with it, because we actually went and developed our own anti-counterfeit software, which is now being implemented on our packaging, which can't be replicated. And if somebody buys something in anywhere, any place in the world, and it doesn't carry the specific set amount of markers, they're going to know unquestionably it's counterfeit.
So is this like a QR code or like a radio frequency identification tag, or what? Like, what is embedded in it?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's a QR code on the packaging. Basically what it does is it allows the person purchasing it, whether it's for B2B use or whether it's for home use, it allows them to see where it was made, the journey. And in the event that they use our app that we built to scan it, in the event it doesn't read it correctly, it's going to mark it as counterfeit. They can contact us directly through the app and we can get on it immediately. We'll know.
Wow.
We can find out where it was bought. We can find out the location, and it will ultimately help us narrow down hotspots and counterfeits. And look, we have some really strong relationships with the authorities, and we build cases every single week because it's a big problem. I mean, you know, we estimate, you know, just over the last few months, we could be bleeding anywhere between $300,000 to $500,000 a month in counterfeit sales. You know, so it's a big deal.
Unbelievable. Can you tell us who are the big countries that are, you know, violating this, or is that
so
politically incorrect?
Yeah, well, no, I wouldn't say it's politically incorrect, but what I will say is that let's reposition it a little bit. I'll say the places that we should have actually put our trademark in first and foremost was China.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what I was suspecting. Yeah. And so how well do the authorities in China work with you to crack down on the counterfeiters, or are they turning a blind eye to this? Because I understand it's rampant in software. So, you know, why not do it in hair care products and all sorts of other stuff?
Exactly. Well, look, I'll share a quick story in relation to that. So we were beaten to our own trademark in China, and we were then blackmailed to buy it. We took a little bit of a different approach, and we leveraged that conversation with that trademark owner to go to the trademark authorities in China. And fortunately for us, we were able to revoke it. So that was the key difference, is that, you know, look, it's a very filthy game. And, you know, you learn it very quick. It's not an industry, and it's not a part of the industry you can afford to be nice about, unfortunately.
Right.
Because look, you know, this is a product that's being used on people's skin. We've had quite a lot of complaints over the last year coming from people who have had chemical burns from the product, and come to find out, you know, it's counterfeit, you know, 100% of the time. And the reality of it is that these people who are counterfeiting it, they don't care what they're putting in the products to make a quick dollar, you know, and it's completely going against everything inside of our being of why this company was created in the first place. So we've invested very heavily in our processes and our systems to weed these people out. And unfortunately, we've been in cases where we've had to come down very hard on a lot of sellers, and we will always give someone a chance. So for example, we have a counterfeit exchange program where if we come across somebody selling a counterfeit, we'll give them the opportunity to still do business with us. And we will also switch out the value of the counterfeits they have in hand for legit products. They might have 500 products, you know, in their store, but they're only going to get 100 from us because that's the value of what they have, you know.
Right. Right.
But we'll give them one shot because we don't want to wrap ourselves up in a bunch of, you know, legal cases. But
wow,
you know, there's been times where it's had to come to that, and every single time they lose. And
so progressive of you to have an amnesty program for these people. Like, I guess they didn't know. So, right. Yes. I mean, we're not talking about the counterfeiters themselves swapping out product. We're talking about the store, the retailer.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There have been cases where we found out that we legitimately believed that they didn't know. So we're like, okay, well, look, we don't want to punish you for that, but we want to let you know that, look, you know, you can still do business with us. It's just, you can't do it this way.
Wow. World-class education you've gotten, my friend.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the only way to learn it is to go through it. I don't think there's
any... They don't teach you this in business school, do they?
No. And there's not a single piece of advice you could be given to learn that. It's like, you can be told that this is the way it is, but until you go through it, you don't have to problem solve it. And that's, I think that's the key difference, is that we can share information on it all day long.
Yeah.
But until it's your brand and your motivation that's being challenged, it's never going to truly mean as much to you, you know?
So let me understand this. Did this happen because you were outsourcing your manufacturing to China or places like that? Or was it just the product just got reverse engineered and then copied?
It didn't even get reverse engineered, Jonathan. What happened was they were like, this is really nice packaging. This is a great brand. You can tell it's the most popular. It is the most popular in the industry, unquestionably. Mm-hmm. But they were like, what can we put in this bottle that looks similar and performs kind of similar? So, you know, what they ended up doing was, you know, in a lot of cases, putting, you know, wood glue into the bottles. And sure, it's full of chemicals. It's like, it's going to hurt, you know? So, and then people are wondering why all my hair isn't staying on, or it's not holding, or I'm getting reactions or allergies or burns. And it's just like, look, I'm terribly sorry. We've been in cases where we will do everything in our power to help the individual. But it's a learning curve. You know, you always have to look for legitimate sources to purchase cosmetic products from. You know, it's very difficult to know in this day and age, and especially online, where, you know, what store is actually legit unless it's a household name.
Wow. Well, this was a great 45 minutes I just spent with you. I loved it. And, you know, your flexibility, your clarity, your dedication to putting people first, the thought of making sure you have the right people in the right seats doing the right things, and that you guys have bonded as a family, no pun intended, right? Yeah, no pun intended. The glue that goes in the hair is really through the organization. You can see the integrity that is there. It's great.
I appreciate that. Yeah, look, we care about what we do, and you know, look, we care about, you know, we care about people. That's just how we were brought up. So we like to think everything moving forward will reflect that. And you know, the reason people will choose to do business with us is because we know, or they feel and they know, they're not just a number. It's, you know, we care, you know.
Great. So Ryan Margolin, Professional Hair Labs. How can people get a hold of you? What's the best way, or how can people find your products?
Yeah, look, I mean, you can find our products in every major retailer online, you know, Amazon, Walmart. You know, you can contact us through our website, prohairlabs.com. We have social media channels all over the place, Facebook, TikTok, Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn, so, you know, there's many channels.
Super. Really enjoyed spending this hour with you. Any final words you want to share? Any thoughts?
Yeah, no, just look at, you know, whether you're in a family business, or whether you're just starting, or it's your own entity or whatnot, you know, just look, you know, just keep going, because, you know, it's difficult to build a brand in this day and age because there's so many other competitive products and other products like that out there. So just remember, you know, the work has to come before the belief, and, you know, don't expect any pats on the back. You have to be patting yourself on the back for the first while. So, but just keep going.
Yeah, it's tough work, but I like to see. I like what you've done. You truly are a disruptive successor. You found a niche. You've owned that niche and are dominating it. And you know, I think that has been a great learning lesson. And some of what you've shared today has been great learnings for entrepreneurs on their journey. So, thank you so much.
No, thanks very much, Jonathan. I appreciate you having me.
All right. So guys, if you like this, please subscribe, share it with others. And if you need some hair care products, check out our cosmetic products, check out Professional Hair Labs. This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, the Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Thank you for joining us on the Disruptive Successor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, review, and share with a friend who would benefit from the message. If you're interested in picking up a copy of my book, Disruptive Successor, go to disruptivesuccessor.com.